Log Talk Radio.
Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we're meriting to stay alive in this most existential of moments, configured to the path of eternity. You're now tuned in to Blog Talk Radio, and we humbly assert that this is the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. This is Soul Class. We happen to be Soul Class 739 in conversation with Wayne William Snellgrove. Blessed is our eternal creator, Baruch Hashem, shalom, peace, and blessing upon the entire human family experience. With creator's help, our next broadcast is taking place right now on Thanksgiving, November 20th, 2019, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island equals USA equals AKA Unified Soul Actualization. A guest, a unique one, that will be today featuring Wayne William Snellgrove, Native American lecturer and teacher of Native spirituality, genocide survivor, U.S. swimming national champion, now the author of a book which is opening up eyes, minds, and hearts and souls daily. It's called Daily Medicine with Each Passing Day. Snellgrove will reflect upon this day from both sides of the coin, namely growing up estranged from his people's traditions and embracing them after he's already has advanced into his adulthood. And his perspective can empower any human at any age. If you'd like to participate in the second half of our program, you can call in at 347-838-8669. If you've picked up on our promotion of today's program through Facebook or on my Blog Talk Radio radio channel, which is Don Zuccia Goodman, you can click on a link to Amazon.com where you can pick up his wonderful book. I have been merited to get the preview of the book, and I want to read from the introduction. But before we go any further as well, I want to mention that connected to the link to today's program is a wonderful video where Wayne William Snellgrove gives a autobiographical sketch which will help you even deepen your interest in daily medicine. And it's sort of like there can be a symbiotic relation between that video and the book Daily Medicine. Without further ado, our esteemed guest originally from Canada, Wayne William Snellgrove. Good evening, sir.
Oh, thank you for having me. Very honored to be here. Again.
Yes, so. Yes. Hopefully there will be more than just tonight as well. Wayne William, I'd like to, first of all, you know, as I recently learned that Thanksgiving as a holiday, an American national holiday, was only instituted in the time of the president, I think it was the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. But really,
yes,
we have to be thankful for every day. Now, I just want to tell a little interesting story. My mother, unfortunately, I was not able to visit today. I hope to visit her on this coming Sunday, called up my son and asked him if he was able to come to celebrate Thanksgiving. So he said, Grandma, he goes to a rabbinical college in New Jersey. We give thanks every day. And I was explaining to my mother that the word in Hebrew for give thanks is hodu. Now, hodu is connected to a word called tarnagolet hodu, which means turkey. So I said to my mother, we're giving thanks, and we say the word hodu not because there are turkeys in India, because hodu also means the word India. It means the province of the country of India out in the, you know, out in, I guess you call it Middle Asia or Asia, and it means turkey.
Mm-hmm.
We're not giving thanks that there are turkeys in India. We're giving thanks because we know that there is a great eternal spirit. We identified as the Almighty. There are many different names and attributes, but it's really about the spirit. And I'd like to read the introduction to your book, Daily Medicine, before we go deeper into the program. And I think this will give our listeners a little bit more insight into you, and then I'll let you take the ball.
Okay.
Or I'll let you, since you are a former national swimming champion, I'll let you jump into the waters and take it from there. All puns intended.
Okay.
So, blessed souls, here is the introduction to Wayne William Snowgrove, hot new book, Daily Medicine. There is spiritual poetry everywhere. Spiritual lessons are everywhere. This is what the Spirit has told me. This book is dedicated to those teachings. This book has evolved from sharing simple truths from the Spirit on my social media pages for my own spiritual recovery. At first, it was other people's messages, and slowly over time, it would include a few of mine. The big change happened when I created and started my own prayer. Quote, Creator, I will go wherever you want me to go and do whatever you want me to do. End of quote. This prayer is in the true spirit of the quote-unquote hollow bone indigenous spiritual analogy for the conduit for the Spirit, allowing the Spirit to flow through me. My indigenous father, Robert Casius, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, and I spoke at length before. I'm sorry?
That's
how would you pronounce
that's
his
right.
last name? Okay. And I spoke at length before.
Perfect.
Okay. As I spoke before he died, our tradition, Wayne William, is when we say when a person goes on to the next level of life about the lost ceremony of listening. It is one of the many languages of the Spirit, but the first one we have to learn before we speak. Since then, I have taken this medicine of listening to deep and wonderful levels in my life, beginning with quieting my mind and listening for the sound of my own heartbeat. As I continued, the things I listened to begin to speak in silent whispers and echoing ancestral voices. I realized all our ancestors, the trees, the winged, the insects, the four-legged, the fish people, all nations, all life has a voice, had a song, had a wisdom for us. All life had something to offer humanity. This book is what they have said. I want to tell you one thing before I toss the verbal baton to you. This is so entrenched in the Torah of the nation of Israel that I'm literally getting goose pimples on both my right and left forearm.
Mm.
It's a universal wisdom that filters down into creation to each and every nation, and so much more so in this generation of communication, the modern world. So I'd like you to take and comment on your introduction, and then we can get a little, interaction, how you grew from and you were able to gain from the immense pain that you endured being separated from your native ancestry until, I think it was your 30s. Please speak now.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. That was one of the first things that I had written before this book even kind of evolved. I had been in a place early in life where things had happened to me, and some genocide, some trauma, some
right.
Some very horrible, terrifying things. And the journey has been to work through those, to walk through those, to sit with those, to love with those. But it took me a long time to get there. There was a lot of ups and downs, a lot of falls, a lot of missteps. And one of those things that kept me going was that little voice that said, just get up one more time. And I think that's the first time I ever really knew that something beautiful was really out there for me. Because when I come from a place like that, I come from a place of pain, come from a place of sorrow and grief and mourning. I would ask, I'd say, I didn't even have a name for it. I just would look outside my window as a little boy and just say, I just want to be part of. I just want to be part of. I don't want to live in this pain anymore. And I would sit there and I would just listen. I would go outside and just touch the trees. And I don't know if it really has anything to do with my ancestry. Maybe it does, but it's. But I it was a place of absolute beauty in the chaos that was surrounding my physical world. And that's where it started. It was just a little blurb to a little boy that was getting passed around from foster home to foster home, from state-run care, and then later on into I was adopted, but I didn't know what that was. It was just another home to go to. So still I would just sit there and I would listen And that's really how my journey started. There was one other thing that spirit gave to me, and it really served me well when I was in those really dark places, like the orphanage. I can remember my first memory was of a big room and lots of bed and lots of kids, and there was a lot of violence. I don't remember what the violence was, but I just remember it just being horrific. And one of those voices said to me, "The quiet ones survive. The quiet ones survive."
Wow.
And I don't know to this day who that was,
wow,
but I just listened to that, and I survived because there was a lot of kids that left and that I never saw again. And I don't know if they were killed or moved on, or I just don't know, but I was just quiet. And this book is really the end result of that first, my first teaching, my first listening, my first ceremony of really being with building that relationship with the Creator. And that's what we're really talking about. It's not an indigenous thing. You touched on it so beautifully at the beginning. This is a thread that runs through all humanity, and that is so beautiful that you started with that, you know, because that takes away that separation between my heart and your heart, knowing that there's something beautiful, big, and greater out there for us, that we can join together, we can listen together, we can pray together, we can honor each other, we can honor each other's ways. So,
someone told me, and I didn't verify it, that, so to speak, at the very first Thanksgiving feast, which I don't know what year it was, that one of my friends was telling me that the pilgrims, the Europeans, let's say what they were, they were Europeans that came, and the native people, I don't know which tribes they were, at that first feast, the pilgrims were Christians. They celebrated their spirituality their way, and the native peoples of Turtle Island celebrated their spirituality their way, meaning there was no sense of one trying to proselytize to the other. And that, so to speak, is a certain spirit that really, I think, set the, I mean, you know, in Europe, which are basically is our tradition, Israel, this is basically the countries of the Edomite peoples, the European peoples, is that there's always this whole idea of, say, divine right of kings, and it's rooted in the Vatican and the Orthodox churches
right.
What do you call it?
The
Protestant.
Doctrine of Discovery.
I mean, I'm just saying this is what they were rooted in. So coming to America or Turtle Island, there was a sense that people can choose their form of worship and be respectful of others. And unfortunately, the evil, I would call it the evil satanic head of eugenics, which, you know, it was practiced on the Jewish people even before the Nazi, the satanic Nazi movements. But from the Doctrine of Discovery, which I learned from Mohawk elder John Cain, who has a radio show in New York City, the Doctrine of Discovery, which was a papal bull before the Spanish Inquisition, which had a tremendously horrible effect on Jewish people up until the mid-19th century, came to the Americas and tried to remove the humanity, the humaneness, the ancestry of the native peoples of Turtle Island. So what you were experiencing was already just a continuation of a 300-400-year process. People say it did not end. And today, as I understand, it still continues. Could you address this issue?
Absolutely. Well, you know, let's go back to the first. Let's go back to the first issue here, and that's what really, you know, there's a really sad history and beginning to what the history books write, and it's not. I wouldn't even say that it's incomplete. It's I mean, in no way to intend that this is an attack on anybody, but the first when the pilgrims first came over,
the natives there, they didn't understand what they were doing, and they were sharing and they were talking about money, and you know, the indigenous population had no idea what money was. They had no, they were just, they didn't know. And so it wasn't a pretty beginning. And to my knowledge, what my ancestors told me is that there was a great slaughter in the beginning. And then the pilgrims went ahead and they had their, what they call, victory feast. And it really had nothing to do with any kind of natives there. It wasn't even until later on, where they started to become peaceful to each other. So it really didn't start out as the history books stated. It wasn't like, okay, you come over here and we'll sit together and everything's going to be fine. No, it really started at what it really boils down to as a land grab, and you have what I have, and so I don't want you here, so I'm going to kill you. And so that's really basically the way it started. Right. Now, the history books, you know, that's not a pretty history. So, you know, right. So, you know, whoever doctored that up and just said, hey, look, this is, you know, we're going to make it sound like this because it sounds more gentle to everybody. But so with that in mind, then we move on to the doctrine of discovery, where the paper bull said, you know, you can take land from those people that aren't Christian. And they were basically saying, well, they're subhuman. And so my ancestors were considered subhuman. And when the pilgrims arrived on their first trip back, they took slaves back. So that's that's kind of, so it's already kind of started. And that's you know, good or bad, you know, again, I'm not attacking anybody, but this is really the way it started. So it's a business decision. It's a commerce decision. It's financial. So and that's pretty much the way Turtle Island people were treated since the conquistadors, you know, since the first people that came over from Europe. And I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's what it was. You know, and so more traditionalists would call it an invasion. So I don't use that terminology because it's divisive. But and I really try to stay away from this history. I try to make people understand, but now is a time of great division, and that's kind of where it started. So people like us, you and me, we have to bring people together, and that's when that's my goal is to help bring all the tribes together again, and just sit and love and listen and honor and respect. And we can't do that without coming together. It's simply not. There's no other viable solution than just sitting together and just honoring each other now.
Amen. You know, I didn't get a chance to see the video where the title was, once you start to meet other people, you stop hating them. You know, when you start to realize that, I mean, it's a process of growth. I mean, listen, I'm a little bit older than you. I mean, I think about 9 years, and I just see that where I grew up originally in, say, in middle class America, in a place called Paramus, New Jersey, which was for sure Indian land. And there was, I think, the Iroquois were a large tribe in New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken. My parents lived in a place called Mawa, which is, I think, there's still, I think, tribes of them up in northern New Jersey by the New York State border. But there was no interaction. It's only when I started to hear the voices, indigenous voices of, again, John Kane, who's on radio show WBAI in New York City, and also T. Okeson, Ghost Horse, who's from Lakota Nation. But your voice, when William, is unique because they're trying to be educational in a more general way, but your story, because I don't listen to every show they do, but your story has so much about personal empowerment, which acknowledges the struggles, which is a realistic perspective of life. Life, for whatever reason, entails struggles. And in the video, full circle, I mean, I was, my soul was just exalting that one point when you described about how after your adopted mother passed on and then you went through this whole search through the internet and you went back to Canada, out in northern western Canada, and you came off the plane and you were embraced. I don't know if they were directly of your tribe. You can elaborate on that, please. But individuals of your family and friends of the family were just encircling you as the prodigal son, and already you were what, like 31, 32 years old. Can you take us through that process of totally being ripped away and not knowing or not being told who you really were, and then what it is to take us back a little more personal reflection about what it was to walk into that circle of family and friends, your family, your I mean, this is the human family experience, but your own personal family. Can you walk us through that process?
Yes. Absolutely. You know, it's my white mother had passed away, and this is one of the most pivotal days of my life, and I write about it. I'm writing about it now in my next book, and her last lesson to me, her last gift, was telling me what mourning really was. So wow. I'm looking down at her for the last time, crying, just crying, the only mother I'd ever known. Mm-hmm. And I realized that what I was feeling was those feelings I had had my entire life, and no one told me that I could feel this way, that I was in mourning. Nobody said, you know, Wayne, you're adopted, and you have a right to grieve your heritage and your loss. And I'm not saying that out of disrespect to my white family. They just didn't know. Their intention was to love me. That's mm-hmm. all their intention was. And it took me a long time to get there. It really did. But once I realized that, I said that they just wanted a little boy to love. And the problem was mm-hmm. that little boy felt so unlovable. Until this point where I realized that I may have another mother out there. I had lost that day. I realized I didn't lose one mother. I lost two.
Wow.
And so I said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I thought it was for a while. Couldn't tell you how long. Could be a minute. Could be a week. I said, man, that's really, really unfair. This is like the worst day of my life. But then I realized that I can do something about it, and that maybe my other mother was out there waiting for me. And, you know, let me set the stage here. So, you know, what we're looking at is a little boy stolen from the hospital into an orphanage 800 miles away a day later.
Wow.
That's about as close as I came to being Native my whole life. And so when I began this process, I think it was 97 that my white mother Anne passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking through the internet, and this is when dial-up was happening, so you'd have to wait like 5 minutes to dial up.
Right.
You probably remember that. The younger cats, they don't understand that. They just plug on. But I was sitting there. But I had this obsession about adoption reunions. And for days and weeks and months and years, I would go on these adoption reunion websites, and I don't know why. Maybe it was a little voice inside myself. Maybe it was creator just saying, or spirit just saying, just keep looking. But I had this unnatural obsession with just looking. And about 6 years later, I got my adoption records from my dad. And I followed the trail, the paper trail, all the way up to Canada. There was three names and three numbers, and I became a Canadian document expert at that point. And
wow.
So I I found three names and three numbers, and I didn't quite know what to do. I was in such a place where I felt still unlovable. I felt rejected, and so I sat on these numbers for a year, and then I finally came across this one night, this one lonely night in Hollywood, Florida. I came across a Canadian adoption reunion site, and I said, "Hey, I'm Canadian. What's this?" And so I went, and then it was an Indigenous Canadian adoption reunion site, and I said, "Hey, what's this?" And that's the first time they talked about the 60s scoop, and it's a policy of assimilation where the Canadian government would steal healthy kids, healthy children, healthy babies away from healthy homes and healthy mothers. And I said, "Oh my God, no one's ever told me this before." So I contacted the woman that night by email. She responded within 5 minutes and said, "You know, we'll talk tomorrow." So we spoke the next day, and I said, "Look, this is where I'm at, going through the whole story I just told you." And I gave her the numbers. And then I said, "If anything goes south, if anything," she says, "look, you know, this guy's a product of a one-night stand. I was drunk, product of incest." I said, "Look, I can't handle that. Just say, hey, just keep looking. These numbers didn't work out." I didn't want to know either way, because I couldn't handle at that time being rejected all over again, you know.
Right.
And so she said she would call back within a couple of days. The next night later, the phone rang, and I was in the front yard, and I ran into the house, and I picked up the phone, and I ran into the bedroom, shut the door, shut the lights off, and I said hello. And the woman on the other end was the woman that said she was going to call, and she said, "Wayne, I have just spoken to the most wonderful woman I have ever spoken to."
Wow.
And I can't tell you I cried for that little boy. That little boy would look out the window, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, praying to be rescued, praying to be remembered, praying to be wanted, praying for all these things. And all those prayers were answered in that one little statement. And basically saying to me that Wayne, you do matter. There is someone out there that loves you. And that person is your mother. And I just cried. I spoke to her. She cried. I cried. Everybody cried. And the next month, I was on an airplane up there, and walking off the airplane. Now let me set the scene for you. You know, coming from the 70s,
can I ask you a question?
Child.
Were you able to sleep? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Were you able to sleep that night when you after speaking to your biological mother?
No. Well, I think I spoke to her once before I actually got off the plane. The private investigator said, "Look, this is a really sensitive situation. I really want you to take this slow." And I'm not a guy that takes things slow. I've never been that way. And so I called her up once, and she said, "Well, just write her letters for the first couple months and kind of break yourself in, and then make a couple phone calls the next couple months." And I said, "Look, I'll call," and I sent her a letter, and the next month I was on my way. And the remarkable thing is, my whole life I had been embarrassed and ashamed to be Native, to be myself.
Wow.
And I was embarrassed around other Natives because it was just so shameful for me to be Native. So as I was walking off that airplane, a little teeny tiny airport up in, you know, central Saskatchewan, I saw a bunch of faces in the window walking up. And it was the first time, and I can remember thinking this, "I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of myself."
Wow.
And I remember walking around the corner, and I can remember she sent me a picture, so in the mail, and I saw her face right away. And after 32 years walking up that little ramp in that little teeny tiny airport, I felt like I was at home, that there was somebody there that really, really loved me. And they say,
wow,
there's a bond between mother and child that never breaks. And I can attest,
sure,
to that right now. When she, I don't know what I said to her that first time. You know, what do you say to your mom at 32
right.
years old for the first time? What do you say? Like, you know,
wow,
like, how are you? Just doesn't do it, you know, kind of.
Right.
I think I just embraced her. I embraced her, and we just, you know, we fell in love all over again, you know.
Wow.
You know, everything in the past just didn't matter anymore, that we were here, that we were there. And then my sisters were there. My brothers were there. And I had three sisters and two brothers, and they embraced,
wow,
me, and they loved me, and they took me back to the house. And they fed me, and we just talked, we just sat, we just listened to each other, and we just and it was just beautiful. It was the beginning of a beautiful healing. That itself was a healing, but sometimes those kind of healings lead you into other healings. And so that's my story, and that's it was the beginning of an evolution of healing for all of us. You know,
wow,
you know, it was a victory.
May I ask,
yeah,
were you the only one of your siblings that was kidnapped in that hideous fashion?
Well, in that fashion, yes. The sixties group, my four older brothers and sisters were all taken to residential schools. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, that's another story. That's another,
yes.
You know, that's another story for another night. But it's.
Right.
You know, but we're, you know, the thing is we're all survivors, you know, and to be alive and to feel that and go through that and to walk through that and to know that one of the first things she told me, and forgive me if I start to cry, is that,
okay,
they celebrated my birthday every year.
Wow.
That I was gone. Every,
wow,
year.
What was your mother told?
Every year, they.
What was your mother told about you?
Well,
did they say, were you told,
they
did you told that you didn't make, survive the birth?
That's what they told her in the very beginning. But mothers are,
wow,
moms in the feminine. They're smart. They're smart. They know. They know. They know. And they said, well, he didn't make it. And then my mom said, well, let me take him home to bury him. And they said,
right,
no. And they said, why? And then, so this went on, this just went on back and forth for a couple months. And then finally they said, look, we need you to sign this piece of paper. We need you to sign your parental rights away. And she got up and she left.
Wow.
She got up and she left. She's not going to sign off on giving me away.
Did they threaten her with any, you know, consequences if she didn't sign it?
Well, they went home and they tried to take my brothers and sisters.
Wow.
So almost that day. And so a little side story to that was we lived on Fishing Lake First Nation. And when the government cars would come around, all the kids would run into the bush. And they wouldn't run 20 or 30 feet. They would run 2 or 3 miles into the bush,
wow,
where they had a traditional settlement there. So they gave us housing, but then they gave us a bill saying, well, now you owe us. And so we didn't quite understand that. So my brothers and sisters, every time the car was around, and everybody knew when the car was around. So, you know, they didn't want to get apprehended. And so they
right,
left. And then eventually the heat got so bad, my mom left with my two siblings and left the reserve and went to Alberta for,
mm-hmm,
for years to work in the fields. So,
wow.
So,
ooh, this is such a story. I mean, this is, you know, even, you know, the Nazis, one of the claims that they made was that they didn't really, although I saw something today that basically the history of eugenics, from a certain historical perspective, well, I say hysterical because it is a hysterical notion that there's one people superior to another and only some should survive, that basically started around 1917 in relation to an inpouring, or actually there was basically free border crossings in southern Texas into Mexico. And when World War I started, the American government was afraid that the Germans were going to come in through Mexico, which, you know, the truth of the matter is there was actually they were docked off the port of New York at the beginning of into World War II. You know, and they used to blow up. I'm getting tangential, but I'm saying
the U-boats.
It was irrational fears that led to this. I have to call it as a satanic form of human dysfunctional behavior, and so many different nations, so different peoples. I mean, people don't. You know, the uniqueness of World War II and all the pain and the what we call the towering inferno of human suffering, is that, you know, the Japanese killed 15 million Chinese, the Nazis killed 25 million Russians, you know, so it was more than just, you know, listen, I'm a Jew, I'm sensitive to the Holocaust, but we also be sensitive to the fact that other peoples have suffered, and when we realize this whole thing is just a one big, you know, soup of dysfunctionality because of disconnection from our source of Earth and the one who created the Earth. And comes along your book, Daily Medicine, which I really do believe, when William, in all sincerity, is part of the healing process. Now, I just before I turn the verbal baton back to you, there was a doctor, Reuven Feuerstein, who lived in Israel and did wondrous work with uniquely capable human beings who the world would call, say, Down syndrome children, and some people call them Up syndrome children because they're some of the most positive human beings on the face of the earth. And all nations have certain segments of their population who are uniquely capable as Up syndrome children. So he was commissioned by the American government to actually go out to a Western, I think it might have been New Mexico, Arizona, to do a study on why is there such a high rate of alcoholism and drug addiction and suicide amongst the native peoples over there on the reservations. And he didn't want to do it, but he was encouraged. Again, my mentor, the Lubavitch Rebbe, said, go out and do the study. And the clinical study results were is that when you deny a person from ancestral cultural ways, they will have a greater tendency, and the T, as we say in Hebrew, inclination to want to engage in self-injurious behavior. Can you address that? Because I know you mentioned publicly in the videos and other forms, have you had to overcome your own personal struggles and the healing you
Absolutely.
Got in embracing with your family, and also the healing you got from swimming as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's you know, there's that's a big question. So unless you,
well, you're big enough to handle it.
There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of things going on here. You know, it's not a German weakness. It's not a Russian weakness. It's not an indigenous weakness. It's not a Jewish weakness. It's a human weakness where somewhere in our psyche as humans, there's something in there that says that we, how do I say it? It's kind of like lack, you know, there's lack. We have to be superior, that I'm better, that this is one of the roots of all human spiritual sickness. And we all have it. As far as the indigenous go, let's go back to the migration. The traditional migration has always been migration routes between North and South America, Mexico, up through Alaska, then over by Newfoundland, and back over to South Florida, and then back over to Texas. Has always been traditional routes. And
yes.
So And so when the invasion happened, when the Europeans came over with their doctrine of discovery, they came over with this human weakness of greed. And part of that was taking, enslaving the people, taking away their religion, taking away their land, taking away. You see, as far as indigenous goes, we are connected to the land. When you take that land away from us, there's a great sorrow and there's a great mourning and there's a great loss. There's our identity. It is to the land, and the land identity lives in us. And so when the Europeans came over and they slaughtered us and they pushed us over and we were retreating and we were getting slaughtered and we would fight back, you know, we were losing not only people, our people, but we were losing our connection to the land. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great loss there. There's a great mourning there that's still happening. You know, reservations are nothing more than concentration camps. It's just, you know, that's just the way it is, you know.
Ghettos, as we used to call them.
They're indigenous ghettos. There's no money there. They didn't. You know, in a historical sense, when the U.S. government beat the Germans, there was such a thing. There was such a thing as the Marshall Plan, and when we infused money, we infused capitalism. They didn't do that with the indigenous population.
Yep.
What they did was they gave us infected blankets. They gave us infected food. They gave us so all these. And there's such a thing called ancestral trauma. So all this trauma since the Pilgrims has been, and the conquistadors before them, have been passed down through generation. Our loss of language, our loss of connection to the trees, the birds, traditional hunting grounds, traditional migration from one area of the country to another. We were really one big indigenous family. And so when you take away that, you know, what is left, you know, what, there's a void there, you know, and so they turn, you know, people turn to injurious things like drinking and drugging, and there's very few of us that survived, and there's still very few of us that stand on and press on and saying not give up no matter what, you know. And maybe I'm one of those. I said, you know what, they did this to me, but I'm going to love them anyway. You know what? I'm going to love them anyway. I'm going to forgive them anyway, because they don't want us. You know, they thrive on creating that adversity between peoples.
Yep.
They thrive on that. The darkness, whatever you want to call it, it thrives on that. Well, you know, I don't want to give that any more power. And I just want to say, you know what, to the Canadian government, I forgive you. I forgive you. And I'm going to do ceremony anyway. And I'm going to talk my language anyway. And I'm going to love you anyway. And I say that to anyone that comes to my ceremonies. I've written a book about that. That's basically what it says. And you know what? This is an opportunity that this book, my teachings, my ancestral teachings, the teachings of the spirit, is just to say, move on, and I'm going to love you anyway, regardless of what had happened. And in my story, when I say that I move on, it doesn't mean that I forget. It doesn't mean that
never
our wounds don't exist. Yes,
never forget.
But it means that those powers have no power over me. That's where the real healing is. There are no powers, you see, because I don't want to be trapped in cage by those things that happened to me. When I let them go, when I forgive them, and this is a process. So I'm close to 50 years old now. So this has been a process over my entire life of learning to let go. It's not like we go to one ceremony and say, okay, you're forgiven. You know, the person that beat me up or you know, raped me, whatever, You know, I forgive you. No, this is forgiving. Forgiveness is a lifetime process, and this is something that I've had to deal with, that I'm still dealing with, that, and it's a place in me that I honor now. This is not a place where I run away. I say, you know, if I cry, I cry. And that's a beautiful ceremony. That's releasing. That's healing. And if I have to cry again, then I cry again. And then I go to my elders with this and I say, I am hurting and I don't know why. And they always say, Wayne, just come sit with us. Sit with us and pray with us. And let's do our ancestral medicine. Let's load the pipe. Let's sit together. Talk to me about your tears. Your tears have a voice. And we've forgotten that, you know, so many people get so turned off when somebody cries, and you know, it makes them uncomfortable. They hand you a tear, right. a tissue, and say, "Please don't cry." They're basically saying, "Please don't cry in front of me because you're making me feel uncomfortable." Instead of just listening to those tears and saying, "Not." The Western world says, "What's wrong with you?" The spiritual world says, "What happened to you?" And that's the rub right there.
Can I chime in,
yes.
Wayne William, that my mentor, Lubavitch Rebbe, would cry public over matters that were so painful to him, and he would be in a room of thousands and thousands of Hasidim, and he would cry publicly over, you know, he would lament over certain situations, the spiritual troubles of the Jewish people. So I follow a tradition. King David cried. Real men cry. I'm not of the congregation of saying real men don't cry. I say real men cry, because if we don't experience the vast range of emotions that we as humans can experience, we could become spiritually crippled.
Absolutely. Well, everything beautiful, and thank you, and your mentors were powerful, beautiful men, powerful. And it doesn't matter what faith, what color, what religion, what part of the world, it doesn't matter. If you cry, you're powerful. That's the deal. That's the deal. The seasons, the medicine wheel tells us that the seasons, the fall, the winter are time for tears, the time for crossing over, the time for, we allow time. We allow that space. We allow that sacredness to allow, give us the space and honor us, to allow us to vent, to go through. The moon tells us we go through phases, and some of those phases don't look so good. And that's okay, because it's only a phase. That's what Grandmother Moon tells us. That we, you know, sometimes we go through phases, and we go through phases every year. That's what the seasons tell us. We go through the seasons every year. There's no season that says, "All right, Wayne, you're close to 50 years old now. You have no more tears left to cry." I have buckets of tears to cry in my life. I do. I really, really do. I don't have enough buckets for all those, but I will honor every tear that is in those buckets. And that is my journey. And, you know, and when we learn to cry for others, that's more powerful. When we listen to their stories, when we listen to their pain, when we listen to their heartache, when we connect, and that's what we're talking about here, building and sustaining and maintaining good human relationships. This is not a Jewish thing. This isn't an indigenous thing. This isn't a Christian thing. This is a human thing, you know? And when we have, and in my book, I speak about it, we have to go back to the humanness, you know? Spirit is in our humanness, and we turn that off like a light. And that's not true. It said, well, you know, big men don't cry. Well, that's not true. They told us a lie. They told us a lie when they said
that's right.
You know? You know,
that's right.
So we're building. So, yes, go ahead.
I'm going to say that when people are discouraged from exploring and experiencing the full range of human emotions, they're basically asked to stunt their intellect. Which, if the emotions are stifled, the intellect, it's like the water that's coming in from the wellspring, which is connected to the abyss, is not allowed to go through the piping system to be channeled down to the glass of the 6 ounce glass of water you're getting through your kitchen sink. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's something wrong with the whole system if it can't come down into your sink.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
You know,
can I ask you a question? So you mentioned, have you, you have learn now one of your native languages? Because I want to make a comment on that.
I am learning a little bit at a time. Absolutely.
Beautiful.
Let me share this.
Yeah, sure. I just want to mention, when anyone listening, that I have a proficiency now. I am fluent in the Hebrew, which is my native people's language. And up until the age of 23 and a half, I did not. So I know I've heard other indigenous peoples talking about the pain of the lost language. I want to say, don't give up. Recapture it 1, 2, 3 words a week, and it can become your meditation to learn those words. And you'll see, if you learn, say, 3, 4, 5 words a week, or 4 words a week, that's 52 weeks out of the year, that's 200 words. After 5 years, once you have 1,000 words under your belt of whatever language you want to learn or adapt as your native language, everything flows from that. And now I think in Hebrew. I'm speaking to you in English, so I'm thinking in English. But a good portion of my day, I'm thinking in my native language. And it's, you know, Bob Marley once said, the great Rasta visionary, his home is in his mind. I'm at home with the Hebrew in my mind. And I encourage anyone, native, indigenous person, to don't give up. Don't say they won't let us learn. Like, you can learn the language. And the most that will bless you, because you'll feel more at home with yourself on planet Earth.
Absolutely. You know, there's one more thing I'll touch on the language is when we're talking about flow, we're talking about crying, we're talking really about any kind of emotions. A good friend of mine, Thomas Kingwall, pointed out that when babies cry, when they feel an emotions, they cry, they release. You know, when they're happy, they laugh and release.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grow older, as humans, we forget how to do that. You know, and so that's one of those teachings that the babies teach us. You know, so when a baby cries, don't tell it to shut up or it's bothering you. Just let them go through it, and in a minute or two they'll forget about it, and you know they'll move on to the next feeling. You know, and as far as the language, thank you. And you know, there's so many indigenous out there that don't feel indigenous because they're away from their language, or away from their culture, away from specific ceremonies and stuff like that. And I would just say, and I talk to them all the time, I said, that's okay. Just continue to walk the red road, continue to learn, continue to pray, continue to do, often we don't do because we're ashamed, because we don't know.
Yes.
And so we just, you know, I want you to say this one word with me. Ready?
Yes.
You ready?
I'm listening.
K was on me. Say that with me. K was on me.
K was on me.
That means I love you in Soto. I love you in Soto. So now you know Soto phrase. How's that? So
okay.
I want all your listeners to say K was on me.
K was on me. You said in Soto.
K was on me. Means
in Soto. Soto.
I'm from the Soto First Nation. Yeah, it's Fishing Lake First Nation. It's a tribe in Canada. Yeah,
So sounds a little bit familiar to a Hebrew called Soda, which means a thank you. So you akezuani, I'll say Soda, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, okay, good. You see, this is so beautiful. We're just having a little talk back and forth. Hey, here's all my language. Hey, good. Here's all my language, you know. This is a beautiful healing, and this is a beautiful healing for everybody that's listening, you know.
Amen.
And it's absolutely, it's just beautiful, you know. And so this is what love looks like, everybody. So this is what we're doing here. He's loving up on me, and I'm loving up on him, and we're healing,
amen.
And I'm healing, and everybody else listening is healing, you know. And so when we go back, I spoke before about that human weakness. This is where it begins right here. This is where the healing
amen.
Begins. This is what this looks like. This is what, let's take some time. Let's sit down. Let's listen to each other. Let's tell the stories. I'll listen to your stories of her, and I'll tell you mine, and then we we become closer. And here's a little bit of my culture, and here's a little bit of your culture. And now we're where we not enemies, but we were unaware of each other. Now we are aware of each other. Now we are brothers in spirits now, because we've taken that time. And the more time you take, the closeness, that bond, that relationship, that maintaining that relationship, the stronger that will become.
Now, I'd like to share with our listening audience, Wynn William, two teachings from your wonderful new book, Daily Medicine, which, again, I strongly recommend everyone pick up. From November 27th, yesterday, let our prayers guide the steps we take, not our opinions. And for today, November 28th, our hope shouldn't depend on circumstances but on our faith. You should know, these two teachings right there, Wynn William, are like things that I learned in the Hasidic teachings. I mean, I can't tell you. It hasn't come up yet. I didn't get the goose pimple effect yet, but maybe if I meditate hard upon it, they're gonna appear once again on my right and left forearm. So this whole idea that prayer, you know, people talk about dial up and you know we're connected to a grid, and you know it's a wireless connection. Human beings have been having wireless connections through thousands from the beginning, when we were, you know, taken out of the earth. I mean, can you talk about this? Why prayers are the true light to the steps we take every day.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. You know.
Can you please elaborate on that?
You know. Yeah. Can you read it again?
Let our prayers, this is from yesterday, from your Daily Medicine.
Okay.
Let our prayers guide the steps we take, not our opinions.
Oh, wow. Let our prayers
guide the steps we take, not our opinions.
Well, we are very... We are run by our opinions. This person's bad. This person's bad. I can't go there. I can't go here. This person doesn't. This is kind of. And no, let me step back a little bit. Let me step back. See here. There's suggested instructions in my book that came through very powerfully. And I think one of the mistakes that we do when we do take. When we do read one of these books, it doesn't have to be my book, and just any book, any meditation book, is that we kind of read it, we gloss it over, and then we move on quickly. And that's not really the way of the spirit. Spirit was very 100%. Clear to me about what you should do with this, and so they gave specific instructions. They said, "Wing, let them sit with this. Let them read it. Let them reread it. Let them listen to music to it. Let them sit with it." We haven't learned to sit with these yet. We just kind of read it and say, "Oh, well, that's kind of nice." Or we read it on the phone on the way to work, or you know, we have it like in our office, and we do it 5 minutes before the meeting, and you know, "Oh, well, that's nice, you know." But then, you know, but to be really spiritual, practical for this really. These quotes, these meditations, to take root, is we have to give ourselves the time to just sit with them.
Yes.
And say, this is, and if you say one quote to 10 people, that those 10 people will come back with 10 different ideas about what this quote means. So what it means to me is that let's change gears. Let's remember that prayers come first. That's what it means to me.
Beautiful.
So instead of going into work and saying, "Oh my God, I got a meeting with this guy. Oh my God, I gotta go sit with this guy, and then I gotta run over there, and then I gotta help this guy out. And oh my God, But if we turn around and say, "What's prayer first?" and say, "Okay, I'm meeting with Aaron first thing in the morning. So let me say a prayer for Aaron. Let us not make this about me. Let us see what we can do together. And when I move on to that meeting in the afternoon with all those people in there, I say, well, oh God, she's going to say this. She's going to do that. She's going to, you know, take the meeting hostage. No, let's, those are opinions, but let's just say, hey, okay. I send a prayer to that room of light and love. I give love to everybody Amen. In that room. And the definition of love that came through, and it's in my book somewhere. I couldn't tell you what page it is. But the definition of love, when I tell your brother that I love you, that means I want everything good for you. It has nothing to do about me.
Beautiful.
But the opposite of that is you would say, Wayne, I love you too, which means you would want everything good for me, because everything has to happen in a circle, in cycle. And like it has to be an offering, it has to be a giving, it has to be an offering. And when I offer that love to you, it's just offering a spiritual space for you to get everything that you need spiritually, like courage and wisdom and willingness and whatever that looks like. And you would say, Brother Wayne, I love you too. And that opens that space in me for that to happen. So it's not, love has been held hostage by the word. It really means business now. I love you. And then you say to a partner, right. Well, that really means, you know, what can I get you for? What can I use you for? What can I abuse you for? That's not what love is. We're like if I want something from you, that's a business. We're in the business of a business, but we're calling that love now, and that's not love. That looks like codependency. That looks like a lot of other things, you know. But it's just when I release all that and I say, I love you, which means I want the best for you and nothing from you. That is true love. That is true
Beautiful.
Love.
Yeah. I'd like to conclude with today's entry from Daily Medicine. Our hope shouldn't depend on circumstances, but on our faith. Now, I recently came across a teaching from our oral Torah tradition, Wayne William, that there was a question asked of a sage a couple thousand years ago, that what is a day that all peoples are happy? And the response was, well, that's a day when it rains, and that all people are happy when it rains. But yet today, unfortunately, from the disconnected human consciousness and the understanding of you know, the symbiotic relation between heaven and earth and earth and heaven, that rain is now looked at as, it's a dreary day, and days where there's, unfortunately, where it's very cloudy, sometimes where there's too much rain. I just recently learned that, unfortunately, there's a higher rate of suicide. But yet from ancient people's consciousness, it was a day of joy. So the circumstances should be dictating us to be happy, yet people are relying on the circumstances to making them sad. So or if depressed, even to get involved in self-injurious behavior, until the ultimate self-injurious behavior is to take one's life, instead of we should be relying on our, we don't understand everything that's transpiring in the physical creation, but we should believe that it is all for our best interests. And this entry today, our hope shouldn't depend on circumstances, but on our faith, is how I take, you know, look, I'm adding my own addendum to this teaching. Could you comment on that?
Oh my God, where do I begin? This is, you know, let's go back to the rain. One of those spiritual principles that we have to work away from that I've noticed in the human consciousness, we talk about awakeness, is that we are spiritually dyslexic.
That's a nice term.
You know,
nice term. Like
and
that.
When we talk about the rain, you say, oh, you know, I'll save it for a rainy day. Or, I'll just, you know, we know. But then we listen to an elder, an indigenous elder, and we say, water is life. You know, and say, oh, well, water is life. Oh, well, you know, and water is life as long as it doesn't rain. You know, kind of thing, you know, you know, so water is water. Water is beautiful. Water is cleansing. Water is life for Mother Earth. It's to be cherished and loved Sometimes it comes in hard. Sometimes it comes in real misty. But but you know, we have to honor that, man. We have to honor Father Sky. It is cleansing Mother Earth, you know, and spiritually it is really beautiful. So just say, okay, it's raining, I'll get a little wet. That's okay. I got a dryer, you know, so it's that's okay. I that love centeredness, that conscious awareness. I mean, some people call it faith, some people call it awakening or something, yeah. You know, we need to be more centered in those things that are beautiful and those things that are right. You know, when it's rainy, that's a beautiful analogy. When it's rainy, I'll say, good, thank God Mother Earth is getting a drink. Thank God. It's not all about us. You see, a lot of us are so selfish and self-centered, you know. We're just, oh, man, it's rainy, you know. It's just, oh, God, it's dreary, it's rainy, and it's cloudy, it's just it's all this. But really, it's still a beautiful day. And you know, if you want to really look at it really hard, like 97% of the light is still coming through. So, yeah. You know, this is because it's kind of rainy, it's dreary, and there's a lot of light out there. We just don't see it. You know, right. We forget it. So right. Kind of bring it back to that faith, that faith consciousness, that awakened consciousness, you know, just kind of live in that moment. Just be in that, kind of being in that awareness, you know, again, being in that moment, just saying, okay, you know, because we don't understand, we forget that we live in the moment. We forget, talk about yesterday and tomorrow and then what's coming up in 5 minutes and I got to go meet them and over there and I'm going to be late. We just don't live in the moment. Right now, everything is okay. Everything's going to be okay. Just do the next right thing. You know, that's what faith really is. Just do the next right thing is faith.
Beautiful. When William, I believe it or not, we've actually spilled over into a little bit more than an hour. That's okay because we're not commercially sponsored. I'd like to thank you for coming on, which was a very quick, dynamic, organic hour. How can other blessed souls who are listening to the program live or will eventually hear the archive version, how can they connect with you and how can they purchase your book, which it is accessible through Amazon.com. Maybe there's another means by which they can acquire daily medicine.
You can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's, anywhere books are sold. You can go to Books & Books. You can go to anywhere and you can order the book. I am on social media at Wayne Williams Snell Group on Facebook. That's my main page. So
beautiful. And I humbly offer a prayer with my faith that your voice becomes a national voice, not just on the Canadian side of Turtle Island, but in the North American side of Turtle Island, the voice in the South American was of Turtle Island, because I think your story, your growth, everything you've accomplished and yet have yet to accomplish, I think is a tutorial for being a faithful steward according to your prodigal son ancestral ways. And it will be a tutorial for every other human being who learns about your ongoing blessing to be a faithful steward of the earth and to servant of the Creator. So this is my prayer for you and my wishes and blessings for you. And I hope that we will do a third and fourth and fifth program, because we didn't even get into the realm of swimming. There's questions I want to ask, but you know, I was once on a swimming team. I wasn't so good, but talking about how swimming was part of the healing process. So hopefully, the program or in the coming weeks, we'll make a radio date. And we'll pass along the verbal ping pong or the baton, whatever you want to call it. So I want to thank you for coming on today. Any one last nugget or one last matter you want to share with our blessed ones before we sign off with a segue ending song?
Today, if you fell down, if you slipped, know I love you.
Amen.
Stand up again and try it again. Stand up one more time. I love you.
Amen. Thank you again for coming on for today's program. And this truly to me has been, I think, the most all-around, most satiating, Thanksgiving, which hopefully I'm going to take in tomorrow and the next day and the coming days. And hopefully I will have the blessing to integrate this as part of the into the rest of my life consciousness to share with others. Blessed souls, this has been Wayne Williams Snowgrove from Saskatchewan, Canada, who has lived for many years also, I think, in Hollywood, Florida. We're going to end today's program by a song by a brother, David Dome from England, Help Me Find My Way Home, which hopefully will be in the way of a Havachad, one love, Gurlachad, one destiny, calling for all of us with a dark and home, dark and shalom, a pleasant, peaceful way. And it is my obligation and is my great merit to remind everyone, when William has got to be good, I done Zussi Goodman have to be good. We all got to be good. It's a Tevatov Lehati, which is nature, the good, the do good, the creator is the source of our goodness. And he waits ever so patiently. The creator is really not a he, it's a supreme being who has spoken, the world came into being, who waits for us to activate that divine image, which is our human intellect, which should be configured to scrimmage and be faithful students to preserve this earth. Let's make the earth great again. Take care, everyone.
We're off.
My world, take up my